Sorry, Matthew.
What's the difference between the attitude of Theravadins and Mahayana to the laity? I mean, I know that's much too general.
So the question's being asked about the attitudes of the monastics, I take it you mean, within Mahayana Buddhism and in, well, you mentioned Theravada specifically, which Theravada would be the kind of descendant of what I was referring to as Nikaya Buddhism. So Theravada Buddhism, if you don't know, is the Buddhism found in southern Asia, like Sri Lanka, Burma, Cambodia, places like that. And I would say, and this might surprise you, it might not, that they're quite similar. The attitudes are quite similar. There's a widespread view. Mahayana Buddhism is for the lay people, and it really welcomes lay people and lay practice. This is a kind of widespread idea. And where does this idea come from? It comes from Mahayana Buddhist texts, because they say that their goal is a universal goal. They say that their goal is not just for a small number of people, but for everybody. But actually the reality is, for most of its kind of historical, in most of its historical instances, Mahayana Buddhism has been just as elitist as Theravada Buddhism has, and remains so. So just to trace that back a little bit, so generally speaking within Buddhism, the community, if I can call it that, is divided into two tiers. Yeah, a lower tier, which is the lay people, and a higher tier, which are the monastics. And monastics usually means monks rather than nuns, especially in Theravada Buddhism. In Mahayana Buddhism, there's certainly more nuns. There's no question about that. And actually, even in the late 20th century, there's been quite a, I don't know about an explosion, but increasing popularity of women's ordination, particularly in East Asia, especially in Taiwan. I'm not sure that I can explain to you exactly why this is, but there are many, many women being ordained as nuns in Taiwan. A fair number. But yeah, so going back to the main point. So there's this two-tier community, and the rhetoric of Mahayana Buddhism is to suggest that actually it sweeps away this two tiers, and actually we're all just Buddhists, and we all just practice in the best way that we can. We all follow the Bodhisattva ideal. But it would appear that in reality it's never really been like this. Most of the time it's not really been like that. The monks have been the full-time professionals, and the lay people, just in the same way as in Theravada Buddhism, would practice dana, that is generosity, and that might take many forms, giving food or a donation or sponsoring the creation of a statue, etc. These kinds of things. I just want to modify that view a little bit now. And I mean, I'd like to suggest that probably the first time that Mahayana Buddhism presented a goal that was addressed to everybody in a kind of sustained way was probably in Japan around about the 11th century. So this is like over 1,000 years after Mahayana Buddhism was first formed. Certainly it's the case that there were traditions before that in China and elsewhere where lay people had significant roles. I think that's true. But actually, for the first time at that stage, you had some teachers, and I'm thinking of one in particular, or I'm thinking of two in particular actually, one called Shinran, who proclaimed that actually salvation, if I can call it that, awakening was not to be accomplished by living a particular lifestyle, i.e. the monastic lifestyle, but simply through invoking or calling upon the Buddha's name. So that's something that anybody and everybody can do. All of us can do that. So that presented a universal goal. Another example, the second example that I'd like to bring up, who I mentioned already, was the monk Nichiren. And Nichiren was a monk, but he didn't necessarily preach that everybody should be. And his message was that all you need to do is to devote yourself to the Lotus Sutra, and more specifically that meant reciting the title of the Lotus Sutra again and again, and that would bring about your liberation. So these particular the traditions that these people initiated, I think, did genuinely present a goal for everybody, but these were a long time down the development of Mahayana Buddhism. I know it's quite a long answer, but please feel free to disagree.
Where does Zen fit into all of this?
Yeah, sure. Good question. It's interesting that...
Could you repeat the question?
So the question is, where does Zen fit into all of this? It interests me that probably if you stopped anyone on the street and you said, have you heard of the word Zen? They'd say, yeah, of course I have. And if you ask them, can you tell me anything about it? They'd probably be able to tell you it's Japanese, I should think. They might say it's something about simplicity or something along those lines. But if you stop somebody on the street and said, do you know what Mahayana Buddhism is? You know, 9 out of 10, probably 99 out of 100 people would say, I've never heard of that. I've no idea what that is. I mean, would you agree? Yeah. And yet, Zen is a form of Mahayana Buddhism. So Mahayana Buddhism is actually much greater than Zen. Zen is just one tradition within that, and yet we've all heard of Zen, but we haven't heard of Mahayana Buddhism. I mean, this is the nature of kind of cultural transmission, you know, and this is it's got a lot to do with how, well, the 1960s and the interests of certain English and even Japanese people in the 1960s, and well, perhaps a little bit earlier as well. So where it fits in is that Zen is a form of Mahayana Buddhism, which originated in China, where it was known as Chan, and then evolved in various ways. It transmitted to Korea, where it's known as Son, or something like that, and we know it through its Japanese form of Zen. And I was speaking a little bit about the idea of the koan, and the koan is a practice that is pursued within some Zen traditions, not all, but some Zen traditions. I'm definitely at the level of my on the limits of my competence in talking about Taoism, but I think what I can say to you, is that I think it might be we might intuitively think that you would associate Taoism with China, yeah. So we might intuitively think that there was Taoism. Then Buddhism came along and something happened as a consequence of that. But actually, it's not really like that. Taoism, in anything like an ism, didn't really exist before Buddhism. And quite ironically, the formation of Taoism as a distinctive tradition was to a significant degree a response to the emergence of Buddhism and also an absorption of certain Buddhist elements. And obviously, Buddhism itself absorbed certain Taoist elements. So the relationship is quite complex, I think. And one scholar who is very respected in all these things, called Eric Zirka, he would distinguish three, we'll call them for the moment, religious traditions in China, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. But the important thing about these is that on the general level, the level of every day, they're indistinguishable. They're just what everybody does. They're the general culture. And he proposes, and I think this is sort of quite widely accepted, that they only become more differentiated at what we call the elite level. So at the level of distinctive priesthoods, this kind of thing. Does that make sense? Yeah. Well, exactly. So I'm suggesting to you that Taoism didn't come first. That actually... Chinese Buddhism evolved coterminously with a Chinese Taoism, yeah. Although it'd probably be reasonable to say that Confucianism was around. But again, Confucianism itself was influenced by and responded to Buddhism as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think I'll talk about those when I get onto the Majjhimaka. Yeah, the question was, I haven't talked about the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, and I appreciate that point. And one of the things about making generalizations is that they're always wrong. because, you know, I'm talking quite a lot about, I think I was talking about a visionary literature, a literature of the fantastic, and so on. Actually, not all Mahayana scriptures are like that. Some of them are much terser, much denser, much more philosophically even convoluted, we could say. Certainly quite hard to penetrate. And there's a whole corpus of texts which are known as the Perfection of Wisdom texts, which are very, or many of them, are very philosophical in nature. And they concern quite subtle issues of Buddhist philosophy. But we will be returning to those, or we will be introducing those in some detail. I think it's week 3 when I look at the idea of shunyata.
Thank you very much. Thank you.